brief, we have presented 10 issues, all of which we believe are meritorious. I understand the court is interested in three of those.
We're not saying the others aren't. We're just saying we need, we'd like you to emphasize those.
I want to point out to the court that before we get to these issues, there's one overriding question this court will have to look at. And that question is, can a person who is intoxicated consent to sex? In this case, Gordon was 22 years old when he had a sexual encounter with his sister-in-law, Jessica, who was 16. As we know, the encounter occurred in a family home, the mother's home, where Jessica was resided only on weekends, every other weekend, and Gordon lived there every day with his wife, Jamie, and two children. The encounter that occurred on a day when Jessica said that evening she was going to go out to the movie. However, she lied. Instead, she went to a bar where she met up with Gordon and his wife, Jamie, and she was able to obtain alcohol. At the age of 16, she was served alcohol and became intoxicated. When she arrived home, she went upstairs, told her mother that she was home, went back downstairs, and went to sleep on the couch. Subsequent to this is the sexual encounter that resulted in Gordon's conviction, for which he's now serving a life sentence. At trial, the state argued that because Jessica was drunk, she could not consent. And I believe that legally is incorrect. Because if a person who is drunk cannot consent, then there would be a lot of people guilty of sexual assault because people frequently drink and then have sex. And if you look at the sexual assault statute, the legislature has never specifically said that's a per se crime to have sex with someone who's intoxicated. The reason this is important is because this is part of the state's theory of the case. And it goes into the first issue where we argue that by excluding any evidence of the prior abortion, Gordon was not allowed to present his theory of defense. So
wouldn't that be covered by the rape shield law? I mean, the judge did allow the testimony about her medical condition and allowed an examination there, but her prior sexual history, which apparently resulted in a pregnancy, is not allowed.
Well, at first it's important to point out that when Nurse Ebert questioned her and examined her, she lied about the prior abortion, the prior pregnancy.
Right.
And some of the symptoms that Nurse Ebert used as an expert to come to a conclusion that the injury she found in the vagina at the 6 o'clock position was evidence of the evidence that the sexual encounter was not consensual. However, since we are not allowed to get into what the gynecological procedure was, that it was an abortion, what procedures were used, or how the medication would affect her, the medication she would have been on afterwards, we were precluded by our own expert, Nurse Fogno, to present that evidence to let the jury make a decision as to whether or not the injury could have resulted in consensual, non-consensual sex. If the court looks at jury instruction 19, the jury does not have to go with the opinion of either expert. The court instructed the jury that what they need to do is examine the reasons that the expert used in making her opinion. But by excluding any testimony regarding to the type of procedure, I don't mean just the name, I mean abortion versus gynecological procedure, everything was excluded. They could not get into all of the details of an abortion. And by doing that, they denied Gordon a right of cross-examination of Nurse Ebert because she could give her opinion and not have to substantiate it. And he was denied his right to present a defense through Nurse Fogo because she could not get into the procedure. If you read her testimony, she skirts around it because that's what the court required. If you read Ebert's testimony, she skirts around it, but she says very adamantly that procedure could not have resulted in any injury here, it could not account for the sex being non-consensual. She was asked, do you testify you don't think the procedure would have caused the injuries that you found? She said, definitely not. The procedure Jessica had, when a speculum is inserted, they would be using lubricant, and she would have been sedated. There would be no injuries. We couldn't contest that. We weren't given the medical records. We were not allowed to cross-examine as to what the procedure was. Ebert actually didn't have the medical records either. Nobody had the abortion records. So there was a problem with us not being able to cross-examine their expert. And this ended up being one expert against the other. Because we know that Jessica could consent even if she was drunk. So what else did the state have? They relied very strongly on this physical evidence. And then we were precluded from bringing any evidence forward to dispute it. So we were denied our right to present a defense. I know the court said, well, isn't that protected by the rape shield law? We weren't introducing it to say that she was a bad person. We weren't introducing it to say, well, she had this affair with Gordon's brother or anybody else. Or we weren't introducing it to say how many abortions she had. It was going to be introduced to dispute the injury. And so it was relevant and clearly should have been admissible and was not barred by the rape shield law. It's important to know the rape shield law, NRS 50.090, has to do with when the defendant is challenging the credibility of the alleged sexual assault victim. NRS 48.069 is used when the defendant is proving consent. Now, we were not proving consent, but we were disputing the injury. So I suppose you could say indirectly we were trying to prove consent. And under NRS 48.069, we're entitled to a hearing. We filed an affidavit ahead of time outlining Ms. Fogner, who is extremely renowned expert in the area of sexual assault. In fact, the curriculum vitae is 26 pages in the appendix. We filed a motion ahead of time and included her affidavit, which explained why evidence of the abortion was necessary to show that this was consensual. So we followed the rules, but the court went ahead and sanitized what occurred and made it look like Jessica had a pap smear. That's not what happened here. So this issue is very important, and this issue alone would be grounds for reversal. Like I said, we were not introducing it to say she was a bad person. We had a reason. They had an expert who came in and said, these injuries show that the sexual act was not consensual. And she didn't divert from that conclusion the whole time. Now, with regard to the comment on the right to remain silent and the fact that there were so many errors that there's cumulative error here, the comment on the right to remain silent, court's indulgence, which is issue number 10, the prosecutor said in closing, and actually she said it twice, not once, because when I went back and read through it again last night, I saw that she said it twice. And she said, if you only committed a moral wrong and you're charged with a criminal wrong, you say something about it. You don't wait 4 years to say something about it. Clearly she was making a statement that he had waited, he had not supposedly brought up this consent defense before, and that he was now, for the first time, arguing it before the jury. That even though we did not object to that, there was an objection because she also commented on him leaning down as if he was hiding his face from the witness, and there was an objection there. Clearly, this is plain error, and this alone would be enough to reverse and have a new trial. Especially when there was not overwhelming evidence here. I mean, this is an incident that happened in a home. They're friends. They all know each other. There was drinking involved. With regard to the flight instruction, Let me get to that issue. It's important to note that there is a case that says that's automatic reversal. If the flight instruction is used and there is no evidence of flight, there was no evidence here.
Well, Ms. Dickinson, from reading the briefs and reading the state's brief, it looked, I think the state was saying he drove around, he met with somebody, and he didn't come back right away to surrender when he heard the police were looking for him. And tell me why you don't think that would justify the flight instruction.
The night and morning that this occurred, Gordon and Jamie's children were at another house. And the reason Gordon left at that point was to go pick up the children. When he left, he ran into Jessica down the street and Jamie, and that's when they had an encounter, and he learned that Jessica was claiming that she was sexually assaulted. Jamie and him left to go talk about this. He denied it. He denied that it occurred. At that point, the police had never been called. In fact, Jessica has never called the police because it was the neighbor who actually called the police when Bill Alter went and got a gun and was going to try to find Gordon.
Well, how much time elapsed between the time he left when this issue first came up until he showed up to surrender? What are we talking about?
I believe it was 2 hours,
okay.
But I'm not sure.
Okay.
I would have to double check it. It could be longer. I know the police didn't arrive till 11, and I thought he turned himself in around 2, is what I recall. I don't recall it being longer than that. I know that he left, I think, around after 10, because that was about the time that Jessica went in and told her mother she was going to the doctor. I just wanted to touch briefly on the guilt-assuming hypothetical. I think that it's important that the court realize that when the state brought out that question, which was, would it change your mind about his character if you knew that he admitted walking downstairs naked having sex with his wife's passed out drunk 16-year-old, that assumes that he was guilty. And under all the cases that we have cited in our brief, the use of guilt-assuming hypothetical questions to cross-examine a character witness is erroneous because it assumes that the defendant is guilty. And it really has no value in front of the jury and evades the central issue, is the defendant guilty? I only have a little over 2 minutes left, if I could reserve that unless you have questions.
Certainly. Well, let me just ask Justice Gibbons or Justice Sager.
I'm
you
fine.
Can reserve that. Ms. Lucich, on behalf of the Clark County District Attorney's Office.
Good morning. May it please the court. I was the trial counsel. Ms. Dickinson was not. Ms. Dickinson, unfortunately, does not know the facts, and the brief extensively misstates the facts. I'm not saying that it was intentional, but they are not stated correctly in the appellant's opening brief. But since the court has indicated what the court is interested in hearing, as far as the comment on the right to remain silent, I would point out there were two things that they mentioned. One, the comment in rebuttal that he was slumped down. He was. He hid his face before every witness testified, every lay witness.
And there was
the
an objection. The judge sustained that objection on that.
Exactly. It was commented on. It was objected to immediately. The court sustained it immediately, and it was never referred to again. So I would submit to the court that that is harmless. The second thing that they point out that Ms. Robinson said something about moral wrongs and criminal wrongs. I would also point out that that is how the defense opened the trial, talking about there are moral wrongs and there are criminal wrongs. All Ms. Robinson did was continue and point out that, look, they're trying to point out to you folks that poor Gordon, you know, he committed a moral wrong, not a criminal wrong, when in fact he committed not only a moral wrong but a criminal wrong as well. She wasn't commenting on his right to remain silent. She was commenting on the evidence.
Now, but here's the quote, and you correct me if I'm wrong, you know, and I'll get right to it. But it's the statement, I guess Ms. Robinson says, if you only committed a moral wrong and you're charged with a moral wrong, you say something about it. You don't wait 4 years to say something about it. Doesn't that violate the Fifth Amendment, that comment?
I would submit it does not, because she continued. It didn't end there. I mean, she talked about how the defense was portraying, and they said, poor Gordon, he had to talk about intimate details of his sex life with another man in a room at CCDC. And Ms. Robinson pointed out that not only that, but what about Jessica, who had to who at that time was barely 16, had to talk to the same detective in a hospital after having had her vagina violated by a nurse, and then again had to come into court and talk to 14 strangers about those same intimate details. Back then, when the defendant spoke to the detective, and the detective talked about his interview, he did not say that it was consensual. Gordon Laws never told Detective Boucher that it was consensual. In fact, he told Detective Boucher that her eyes were closed, that she was, his words, that she was passed out on the couch, and he, Gordon Laws, told Detective Boucher that she didn't consent. Those are all the things that he said. He never said that she consented. It's only now, all these years later, that we're in trial, that they're putting forth this consent defense. So I would submit that that is not a comment on his right to remain silent. If the court does find that it is a comment on his right to remain silent, I would say that it is still harmless error. I completely disagree with the defense version of the facts. Obviously, this was an overwhelming evidence case. This was a 16-year-old child who was the sister-in-law of the defendant. He was married to her sister. He was the father of her nieces. He was her friend. He had always been her friend. He takes her and her underage sister out and gets her drunk. And in his words, she was so drunk, he had to carry her into the house. He poured her onto the couch. He wanted to have sex with his wife, his own words. She wasn't interested. She was drunk. So he went into his own bathroom upstairs. He decided he wanted to take a shower. So what does he do? He walks downstairs naked. In the brief, it says that, you know, that he did that because he never uses the upstairs bathroom. Well, that's not true. His statement to the detective was he, in fact, used the upstairs bathroom, but then decided to walk downstairs naked to take a shower downstairs. His story to the detective, at first, there was no text, no sex, no touching, no nothing. Then when he's confronted by the detective with, you know, hey, I don't believe ya, he says, well, you know, why would there be DNA, your DNA, in her vagina? Then he comes up with a story about how he was walking downstairs naked, went into the bathroom and masturbated in the bathroom because his wife wouldn't have sex with him, and his, you know, sperm semen got on his hand, and oh, he heard her fall, so he went to pick her up and his finger accidentally fell in her vagina. How many times have we heard that on trial before? And when the detective says, well, you know, I know that there's a difference between a finger and a penis, and the nurse is going to be able to tell the difference between the finger and the penis, then he finally coughs up, okay, I put my penis in her. She didn't want to. Her eyes were closed. They never opened. She didn't consent. She was passed out. So he did confess. This was an overwhelming evidence of guilt case. When she talks about the abortion, not being able to say abortion, they got their entire point across about the whole gynecological procedure. The only thing they weren't allowed to say was the word abortion, which everyone knows is one of the most prejudicial words out there, especially in our community. People are disgusted by the word abortion. They're disgusted by the fact of abortion. So when you have a 16-year-old single girl who is pregnant and has an abortion, what else could they possibly be hoping to gain except to muddy her up? Because it necessarily implies that she sleeps around, that she's irresponsible, and that she doesn't care. They were able to present all of their theory. The fact that she had a gynecological procedure, that doesn't mean pap smear. That means something being inserted in her vagina. And yes, there was one expert that said it could not have caused those injuries. There was another expert that said it could have. The word abortion coming in wouldn't have changed that in any way. It just would have prejudiced the jury against Jessica. So this was an overwhelming evidence case. So I would submit that even if the court finds that his right to remain silent was commented on, which I still submit it was not, it does not merit reversal. As far as the guilt-assuming hypothetical, I was very careful in the words that I chose. That was not in any way a guilt-assuming hypothetical. The words that I chose to ask the Dennis Nolan, you know, and here they have, all they're doing is putting forward a senator to impress the jury and say, oh, he's been my friend for so many years, he's a great guy, he's not violent. So what I wanted to demonstrate was that there is some bias here by asking, well, what, because I knew that the defendant told Dennis Nolan that he didn't even have sex with her. So what I wanted to ask was, would it change your opinion that he's a great guy if you knew that he admitted, which he did, that he walked downstairs naked where his 16-year-old sister-in-law was passed out, which she was, which he admitted, and walking downstairs naked and had sex with his wife's passed out drunk 16-year-old sister. That does not assume guilt. That those words are words that he used. He did say that she was passed out. He did say that she was 16. He did say that it's his wife's sister. He poured her onto the couch, so he knew she was there. It was not a guilt-assuming hypothetical.
Well, I know in the brief, I think your brief makes a distinction between the words having sex versus raping or
so sexual assault.
So you're saying that's what distinguishes it from a guilt-assuming hypothetical, that all those facts were proven there at the trial.
They were proven from his own mouth. Those are words that he used. And the fact that he initially said that, no, that wouldn't change my opinion, demonstrates bias, which is what I was aiming to do to begin with. That he doesn't care what I have to say. He's just going to assume that his friend is a great guy, and that's what they want the jury to think. So it was not guilt-assuming. It was all based on accurate fact. And again, I would submit that even if the court did find that it was guilt-assuming, that it was harmless error, that this was an overwhelming evidence of guilt case. And as far as the flight instruction, again, Ms. Dickinson was incorrect. When he left the house, he knew that something was up. Both Tamara Alter and Tracy, Lindsay's mother, had indicated that he was acting funny that morning. He wasn't acting his normal self. And when he left the house, it is very possible that he just went to get the kids. I would submit that that's not why he left the house. He knew his wife was not there, and he knew Jessica was not there. They were down the street. Jessica and Lindsay told Jamie, the defendant, drove by. Jamie had an absolute fit and started yelling at the defendant. He tells her, get in the truck. She gets in the truck, and they drive to a park to talk about what's going on. Yes, he denies to her that anything happened. He denied to his sister at that time that he had ever had sex with Jessica. He denied it entirely. And it's while Jamie, his wife, and the defendant are at the park that Jamie, his wife, gets a phone call from Lindsay, whether she calls Lindsay or Lindsay calls her, but she speaks to Lindsay, Jessica's friend, and Lindsay tells Jamie, the police were called, the police are looking for Gordon. So they're at the park when he finds out the police are looking for them.
And how much time elapsed between that conversation until he turned himself in?
Hours, many hours, because he goes to his grandmother's house from there. And he knows that the only other person in the family that knows where his grandmother lives is his wife, Jamie. Jessica doesn't know where his grandmother lives. Jessica's mother, Jessica's father, the neighbors, none of them know where his grandmother lives. So he went specifically to somewhere that he would not be able to be found. The police went to his father's house, and he wasn't there. And that was the only other place they knew to look. It was hours later before he finally, and he doesn't even go back to the house, the Brigantine house. He goes to his dad's house. The police then have to go back to his dad's house and arrest him. So he does flee to avoid arrest.
So, but who called the police to say he was at his dad's house? How did that come about? How did the police know to go there to arrest him or talk to him?
I hate to say I do not recall the answer to that. It is possible that it was him. That is possible. I won't say that it wasn't. But he spent hours at his grandmother's house before he went to his dad's house, his grandmother's house where nobody knew where it was. I would submit to the court that that was a proper instruction. And the jury is not told that they have to assume consciousness of guilt. They're just told that they may take that as evidence of consciousness of guilt. They also may not take it as evidence of consciousness of guilt. But there was evidence to support the giving of the flight instruction. Unless the court has any other questions.
Justice Sated, Justice Gibbons?
I believe that I've answered the court's questions. I thank you for your attention.
Thank you.
I would ask the court to uphold its conviction.
Thank you, Ms. Lucich. Ms. Dickinson, your rebuttal?
Your Honor, I don't need to be the trial attorney to know what the facts are. I have the record. I know what the record says. I stand by the facts that I have in here, and the court can look at the record and see that they are accurate. One thing that I can tell you, if you look at the testimony from Boucher, Detective Boucher, and if you look at the statement that Gordon Losnow made, you know that he never said that he knew Jessica was passed out, unable to consent. He never said that. Those words never came out of his mouth. What happened is Detective Boucher said that he asked him, did you know that she could not consent? And Gordon was crying. The record shows he was crying. Of course, we've lost the tape because the state did not properly put it into evidence. But he was crying, and he nodded. The record does not indicate how the nod occurred. Was it up and down? Was it back and forth? Was it going like this? Was it a nod in reference to the question? But Detective Boucher said it was a nod admitting it, and the prosecutors now just said it was not admitting it. That's not what the record says. So for the prosecutor to rely on a nod as an admission of guilt is totally wrong. And to rely on that for evidence of overwhelming guilt is also wrong. There was no confession. A confession is usually a statement. And like I said in our brief, we've lost our ability to challenge that because they lost the tape. One other thing I want to say is that with regard to the hypothetical, in this case, Gordon's credibility was crucial. And so when the state began to attack Senator Nolan's credibility, they attacked Gordon's credibility. And even though the prosecutor says, well, we didn't come out and say that he was guilty, but when they suggest that she was passed out drunk, and they are saying that. They are saying that it was
but Ms. Lucich is saying there was proof in the record of everything she said to back up that statement. And she didn't, I think their point was, as you know, in the brief, was they didn't say it was a rape. They said there was he had sex with the sister, then like that. And that was all established in the record, so it's not a guilt-assuming hypothetical.
And I'd like to add to that, a guilt assuming with respect to the moral wrong versus criminal wrong. I'm not so sure that that door wasn't opened by defense counsel themselves.
In the opening statement, even though they made that comment in opening statement, when it was made in rebuttal, is it all right if I answer that? When they made that in rebuttal, we did not have a chance to say anything else. So they ended with that statement, and that's why it's prejudicial. If we had had a chance to rebut that, we didn't. And I don't think that by saying that in opening allows them to come in and comment on his right to not testify at all. I think it's wrong. And this was not a case of overwhelming guilt. This is a case about was it consensual or was it not.
What about the tape? You were talking about the tape was lost. Was it lost before the trial?
It was lost before the trial. The court held a hearing because the court was so concerned about the tape. The tape was Gordon's statement and Jessica's statement. And when we got the transcripts, there were 265 blank spaces in Jessica's statement. And Jessica had told several different stories along the line, so we knew that she had a tendency to change her story. In Gordon's statement, it was 35 pages, and they were missing 66 blank portions. When the trial attorney went to get this, because he wanted to listen to it to see what he could determine happened in those blank spots, one of which is when there was the so-called nod. He learned that the police department had no procedures for securing these. They put them in a file, they sent it, they get it transported. When the detective Boucher went to find the whole file was missing.
Is that raised in the appeal?
It is raised in the appeal, Your Honor. I believe it's issue 3.
It's raised. All right.
Right. We raised that and argued, and we asked for dismissal because, again, this had to do with the credibility of Gordon and the credibility of Jessica, and we needed a a complete, accurate transcription of what they said when they first were questioned. And we didn't get that. And the court held a hearing. We asked for a reversal. The court did not allow that.
Anything else? Any other questions? Thank you very much.
Thank you.
This case will stand submitted. The panel thanks both lawyers for their excellent presentations and briefs in this matter. And we'll be adjourned until 1:30.